Hello.
Hello.
This is Gabriella.
And this is Claudette.
And you're listening to
Erratic Dialogue.
Erratic Dialogues.
Of the novelist Jane Austen, what more could be said? Aside from Shakespeare, is there an English writer more adored, more feted, more fetishized than this spinster from Steventon, Hampshire? And in terms of adaptation, barring Shakespeare again, is there a corpus that has captured our collective imagination quite like Jane Austen? In her sadly abbreviated life, Jane published only 4 novels in her lifetime, and 2 after her death, yet each and every one of these novels have been adapted in myriad forms and in myriad modes. Today, the film Love and Friendship opened across cinemas in Australia, directed by Whit Stillman and stars Kate Beckinsale, based on an epistolary novel of Austen's Lady Susan, and centres on this titular character, a handsome widow who seeks her fortune by manipulating the sorry coterie of gentlemen and ladies that stray into her path. Gabriella and I had the distinct pleasure of seeing this film last month in the closing night gala of the Sydney Film Festival. So this is a discussion long in gestation, and I'm dying to know what you think.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought it was just so funny.
Yeah, it was funny.
Rewatching it, I thought it was funny. I could rewatch it once more and still laugh.
Yeah.
It's great. It's got all these really fabulous kind of aphorisms, like... Facts are terrible things.
And, yeah. You know,
if she...
Lots of insults about Americans.
Yes.
That I quite enjoyed.
Yes, yeah. It's a really, really well-made movie. Yeah, I really, really liked it.
To sort of prepare you for this, I got you to watch one of my favourite films, is Metropolitan.
Yes.
Which is Whit Stillman's very first film, which in and of itself is a sort of loose adaptation of Mansfield Park.
Yeah.
And I think in his sort of history, he's only made like 4 or 5 films, but they're very reminiscent of Jane Austen. So this is a sort of like homecoming of a sort. Like you sort of feel like this is like the mood that he was meant to create,
yeah.
You know, like this is the sort of film that, you know, he is just perfect for.
Yes, because a lot of his films are people having conversations,
yes.
And you really have to listen.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's very similar to Austen, is you really have to read and listen to her authorial voice.
Mm.
That's where the magic happens, not so much in the, you know, it's not really in the love story. I think that's less important than the kind of little quips that Austen, the authorial voice is making.
Yeah, and it's just really interesting. I mean, we really enjoyed the film.
Yes.
But, I mean, it has, in terms of the people who tend to like these films, it's been quite a polarizing thing.
Yes, yeah.
There's, like, a figure that we follow who said that she walked out 20 minutes into the film, then.
Which I find really interesting. Why do you think that is?
I was trying, I should have checked and seen it exactly at the 20 minute mark when she walked out. I have a feeling it must have been that scene with Sir James Martin.
Right.
Who is this very wealthy buffoon, a very sweet man.
He's a bit of a rattle.
That's exactly how, we have to talk about the amazing title cards. But there's this scene where it kind of feels like he talks about how he confused Churchill because he was thinking of a church and a hill, and so he was...
Churchill. It's one word. That's how you say it. Churchill. Yeah, it's like this amazing scene where this character is just talking and talking and digging the hole deeper and deeper whilst the other characters look on in just absolute, like, dismay. And it's...
Yeah.
They stretch it out, and it's really funny.
It's really funny. It's really interesting because it sort of feels like a Judd Apatow comedy.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a comedic scene that's very much of a time where it's very loose.
Yeah.
And
it creates that cringe.
Yeah. The sort of cringe comedy. And I've never really seen a period drama that's really tried to use this modern effect.
Mm.
And I actually think that I don't understand why people left the film, because I think it's a really skillful adaptation, actually.
Yes.
Especially when you compare it to her other novels, in the sense that Jane Austen makes it very easy for the adapter, because she's a very cinematic novelist.
So I think it's because they focus more on narrative instead of narrative voice.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Lady Susan, which I haven't finished, but I know that you haven't read.
It's only 100 pages, Claudia.
I know. I know. I shall read it. It's very delightful, and I read the end, and it made me laugh, but we can later... There's a sentence in the end that made me laugh out loud. I mean, it's an epistolary novel, so it's all in letters.
Mm.
So there's no scenes, so to speak.
Yeah.
I mean, he uses a lot of the things in the letters.
It's almost verbatim, some of the letters, like in the conversations that they have.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't have the ability, like he didn't have the privilege of, if you tackled Pride and Prejudice, you know exactly how to structure. He, and to a certain extent, he'd have to fill in the gaps of a lot of things. So yeah,
that's... Well, I think it's very interesting because Austen wrote Lady Susan when she was 19.
Yeah.
So it's technically juvenilia, and it's interesting because she's a lot more focused on character types and like certain kind of conflicts and criticizing, like social criticism, than she isn't like a kind of love story. There isn't really a love story at all.
Which is probably why some people don't like
but
it.
Yeah, but for me, it just perfectly captured like the things that I really like about Austen. And
well, we just about 2 or 3 months ago at the Sydney Writers Festival, we saw a one-woman show called Austen's Women.
Yes.
Which I didn't love wholeheartedly, but I thought...
It was very pleasant.
But the salient thing about it was that she really focused on all the really horrible characters in Jane Austen's. Mrs. Norris, I do have to say, was fantastic.
Do you think the cat in Harry Potter is named after Mrs. Norris?
Yes!
Oh my goodness, I just made this intellectual connection. Oh my god!
I know, J.K. Rowling is just amazing.
It's like how Hedwig is named after Hedwig in the Wild Duck.
I didn't know that.
Ah, all the animals! Okay, well that's just... My mind is blown. I'm going to tweet about that later.
Yeah, and like the way in which her face sort of darkened to have that hauteur that Mrs. Norris has was just wonderful. And like, and when she, what she did was that she showed how cutting Jane, how sort of verbally visceral Jane Austen can be, and it's not just about heaving bosoms and dance parties.
Yeah, I think it's really the Mrs. Norris's and Lady Catherine de Bourgh's which are really the fine point of Austen's writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because she's so great at capturing that kind of nastiness, I think.
And it's a nastiness that, you know, 200 and so years on that we still recognise. You have that very contemptuous person who uses education and class to make other people feel lesser or an inflated sense of self.
Yes.
Like, and that, you know, that's a universal thing. And I think that's why, that's part of the pleasure of Jane Austen.
Because those characters always kind of get the stick in the end, which is always very pleasant. Yeah.
And I, thinking of which, Whit Stillman also is like, he sort of has the same thing where he has lots of very horrible characters. Wonderfully by Chris Eigenman, I do have to say, who we kind of love in their nastiness.
Yes, yeah.
But it's actually the virtuous characters, both in Austen and in Whit Stillman's films, who gets the girl or the boy at the end, who is in the happiest place.
Yes.
And so there is a certain moral sort of pattern moral code that happens throughout both of Whit Stillman's and Jane Austen. And so Whit Stillman has sometimes been accused of being right-wing or a conservative director. Mm. So I just wanted to ask you whether you agreed with that, or...
See, I never kind of considered him conservative until I read some articles about him on the internet and everyone... He's telling me he's conservative and that he wrote for, you know, for American Spectator, which is very conservative, which I found...
Did you read that profile on the New York Times?
Yes, yeah.
And it sort of offered sort of this Oedipal theory that his father was very left-wing and that being neglected by his father meant that he felt that he had to create his own persona, and so he embraced this...
But I think, like, is nostalgia for the past, like...
Is that a
I mean, a conservative in a pejorative way. Because when one says conservative in our time, that means, like, you know,
the social modes are very conservative. Yeah. Or this idea that, you know, the mantle of the linchpin of civilization is ultimately a Western one.
Right.
Or, like, it's a Western... history has created the civilized culture that we have. I don't agree with this. But, you know, there is, like, if you're conservative with a small c,
yeah,
that's the type of sort of idealism that you have. So, for example, Metropolitan is a sort of a lament about the dying culture of the debutante season.
But I think it isn't, because all the characters are... He very openly criticizes his characters and shows how flawed they are. So yeah. I think it's difficult because having a moral code or a moral way of seeing the universe, like, I don't know if that's necessarily a negative thing. Like, I don't know. I think it's very difficult to, I don't know, like, but I think, like, yes, he's conservative in some ways because he's yearning for, like, these past ideals to shape society. But then on the other hand, in Lady Susan, it's about a female character who's in a society that, you know, doesn't give her independence or agency. So she does what she can in order to find it.
Yeah.
And I think Lady Susan is clearly a snake, but it doesn't kind of criticize her or condemn her for it.
Yeah.
You're kind of along for the romp.
Did you think she was a horrible person? Did you like Lady Susan?
Yeah, I think she's terrible, but very charming.
Yeah.
What's that one quote that Reginald says about her?
Oh, she has a captivating deceit.
Yes, exactly. Like that. Exactly. You really enjoy watching her. Yeah, we should maybe mention it. Kate Beckinsale was really great in the role.
Have you seen her in other, like, I mean, she's most famous for, like, Pearl Harbor, fighting werewolves. But the first thing I saw her was in
Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, yeah. I think mine was, she was in Emma, a really old version of Emma. She was very good. And she was in another film called Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons.
No,
was sort of in that sort of Nancy Mitford-esque satire space. I've always known that she has a very much a cinematic wit about her. But yeah, I think this is absolutely the perfect role for her. She like, some of the things that she says, especially about her daughter, are so horrible. But she's just so funny. Like, she's never bamboozled. She always knows the score.
Yes. It's kind of like when you're hanging out with that person who's really mean and you know it, and you hate what you become when you're around that person.
Yeah.
And yet, like, you just feel so good when they say something that's so cutting about somebody else.
It's like, it feels very cathartic. So, yeah, no, I loved Kate Beckinsale in Lady Susan.
So my question is he inherently conservative if this film is, one could give this a very feminist reading, you know, that the film is championing women kind of having their own agency and doing what they need to do in order to, like, have a fulfilling life, even if they're terrible, you know?
I feel like this film is probably... I think it's more an issue in his more contemporary films, because, like, this film, like, you're right, it's actually quite a sort of progressive tale about... It's kind of like the sort of justification of a woman like Mrs. Bennet. Lady Susan is much cleverer than Mrs. Bennet, but they're still sort of driven by the same impulse, which is self-preservation. And I think Jane Austen is actually quite forgiving of her characters who sometimes do horrible things. Because it can be a horrible world, especially for women. I mean, Sense and Sensibility is all about the other side of the coin that happens when you lose that income that comes from being married, from having a wealthy father. And it's a distinctly sort of feminine problem because of the laws of entailment and things like that. So I think Lady Susan is, you're right, it is actually quite a feminist fable. you really read it in that way. I mean, like, you know, she ends up in a menage a trois, basically. And, you know, I can't help but think of, like, somebody like Lady Hamilton. I feel like both Austen and Stillman they find her amusing and they find what she says, you know, very cutting and very cruel. But then I think they also admire her, like, forthright honesty.
Well, the thing is, this kind of character comes from Austen herself, you know. Yeah. Like, she has the imagination to construct or the ability to think of people in this kind of way. But back to kind of conservatism, I guess this begs the question of, is Austen a conservative writer?
I guess people who say that she is a conservative would point to Mansfield Park.
Ugh. And yet, anti-slavery.
Yeah, but I think that was the director of the 1999
movie. Oh, no, I think you can definitely read it into the novel. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, no, you're right. There is a scene where Fanny actually does question, you know, like the root of the Bertram's wealth.
Yes.
That is true. As in, I can't remember the full quote in Metropolitan, but it's like, the character who hasn't read Mansfield Park, by the way, he says it's about a novel about this sort of scandal of performing a play privately in one's home, and that's supposed to be a horrible sort of deviant act, but it's only seeing that because we're seeing it from the filter of this very sort of very virtuous but also quite moralistically closed-minded young woman.
Yeah, because I think she's really, I mean, Fanny's problem is that she really finds it difficult to not adhere to authority.
Yeah.
I think.
Mm.
I mean, she marries her first cousin, like, it's just like... I'm sorry, yeah, I'm not going to get into my I really don't like Mansfield Park rant, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. So you think Mansfield Park's a conservative novel?
I think so. Well, I don't know. I think you also have to think about it in context.
Mm.
We probably would see it as conservative, but the notion of, like, women, of people marrying through, overcoming, like, getting married to somebody outside of their class, women taking a certain amount of agency. I mean, like,
yeah.
And Pride and Prejudice on the other side of the coin. I mean, if Jane Austen was all about obedience and duty, as Fanny is, then she wouldn't have created a character like Elizabeth Bennet, who refuses Mr. Collins, but also Mr. Darcy, because she believes in marrying for love, which is still quite... A radical idea. Yeah.
I mean, these novels are inherently about social mobility.
Yeah, which that's I think the phrase that I want to say.
Yeah, which is the greatest argument for Austen's liberalism.
Yeah.
But I think the love plot is what lends itself to, like, modern conservative adaptations and readings of Austen.
Yeah. When you reduce it to woman meets man, and man is usually... in a much more privileged position as woman, like, you know, like, none of Austen's heroines marry down.
Right. Has anybody written or made a film adaptation of Pride and Prejudice where the gender roles are reversed?
I don't think so. I mean,
This could be our Get Rich Quick scheme.
I know, this is, like, getting the podcast self-sustainable.
Let's write this novel.
I'm sure that there's, like, romantic comedies that do, but anything explicitly.
Oh, what about, like, The Nanny with Niles and Miss Babcock?
Yes. I love that your mind went to that place.
I can't believe it. Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah.
No, I love it. Yeah, no, I can't really think of anything. And so it begs the question, I mean, like, is every Jane Austen novel essentially a very skillful Cinderella narrative?
No. No. Okay. No, okay, no. I think it depends what you want from the novel and how you're reading it.
Mm.
And I think this kind of cuts to the... part of a lot of arguments about Austen and what is the right Austen, you know, who owns Austen. Thinking back to the film, and people walking out of the movie are not liking it. Critics have given the film really positive reviews.
Yeah.
It's more like the kind of Austin Jainite group. Oh, should we give a quick definition of what a Jainite is?
Gabby gave me this amazing essay called The Cult of Austin by Deidre Shauna Lynch. And she says that the appellation was adopted around 1894. Mm. So it's been here a long time.
Yeah.
Like the 20th century cannot claim the Jainite. And it's really interesting in the sense that the sort of popularity of Jane Austen has come through a nationalistic thing. It's just like...
It's linked to national heritage and got told the national heritage castles. And it's a huge cottage, industry around it. And I mean, Lynch makes this great point of there is no other writer that has this kind of... this fan club where there's this huge personal identification, like even the name Jainite and calling her by her first name, and she makes the point like the only comparable one is William Shakespeare, but nobody calls Shakespeare fans don't call themselves Willies.
Yeah,
like it's. But what is it about Austen that creates this deep? Oh, but back to my question about Stillman. People's negative reactions to this film, is that because it subverts the idea of Austen, or does it subvert the idea of the Austen industry?
I think it subverts our idea of what an Austen adaptation ought to be and the utility of an Austen adaptation to be, because history has shown us that the love story has always been the centre of this. And Lady Susan does not have that. And in fact, it doesn't centre on a heroine. It centres on... An anti-heroine. A cleverer, more appealing Mrs. Norris.
Mm.
And so maybe there's a sense of identifying with Jane Austen heroines.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, we see ourselves
because
in
everyone sees themselves as Elizabeth Bennet. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Or Anne Elliot. Or... I mean, Emma.
No one's Kitty.
Exactly.
Mary.
I suspect I'm much more like a Mary. If I look deep into my heart.
No, don't say such a thing.
And there's a certain idea of like Jane Austen as like some sort of comfort food. I can't remember the part in the essay. She sort of authenticates this world, this very sort of rose-colored glasses version of like the 19th century that I think that we find very comforting. From a cultural perspective, it's this idea of, you know, the rolling hills of like of the area that she wrote
the hills
in.
And dales. Yeah,
yeah. So kind of like creating this sort of like Arcadia of the past.
Mm. But to kind of take on that, by taking on the past, do you take on all the kind of historical problems that come with it? Like, you know, on a completely quotidian level, there's no flushing toilets. on a more kind of deeper, more disturbing level, it's a time where women have very little rights.
Yeah.
Where, you know, what we would classify as Edward Said's other had, you know, even less rights.
Yeah. Being a person of colour, I'm completely excluded from this narrative.
Yes.
I do not exist, or if I exist, I am being exploited off screen.
Yes. So it's, and when you think about it in those terms, it's very, very disturbing, because it's essentially saying that Austen is for white people.
Yeah.
And that's very, I don't know. I don't know if, can Austen be, because in Austen adaptation, I think, Clueless, for example, is the only Austen adaptation I can think of, or Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
The Bollywood Pride and Prejudice. Yeah. But Clueless is the only adaptation that features an African-American.
Yeah.
Because in the classical adaptations, there's no one who's not white.
Have you seen Lost in Austen?
Yes, yeah.
I love that film in the sense that, the miniseries in the sense that it shows the ridiculousness of, like, a modern woman living.
Yeah.
But then she ultimately stays in that period.
They bloodletted. I mean, it's just,
there are no people of colour. There's a book called Longbourn by Jo Baker.
Right.
That is Pride and Prejudice from a perspective of one of the Bennet servants.
Mm.
And Bingley has, like, a... was a sort of servant who's African American, who's also not African American, African, who's a servant, and so she sort of kind of inserts this element of race. But in this day and age where we talk about representation and diversification in media, I mean, period drama is an issue because period drama is often where British actors and Australian actors become famous. I mean, you have the Tom Hiddlestons of the world, the
Benedict Cumberbatch. I mean, it's kind of ironic that Shakespeare has more opportunities for diversification than Austen is 200 years later.
No, it totally is. And actually, you know, I think you can pretty much pinpoint, every single British actor has come to America has in some way, shape or form been in an Austen or period drama adaptation. And also, I mean, it's also very class-based because a lot of these roles, a lot of these actors come from
Eton and Cambridge.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty universal. Yeah. It's actually very, very difficult to find somebody who does not come from that sort of really upper echelon of education. But it's this cottage industry of period drama that sustains this sort of system.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, this aspect of race and class. I mean, in taking on the kind of Austen or the Jane Eyre persona or the kind of love for Jane Austen, is that act inherently racist and classist?
Oh, God.
because when you, like, let's imagine a world where someone makes an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice set in the 1800s, the costume drama, everything, but Lizzie's happened to be played by a black person. I would love that, but is that possible in any way, shape, or form?
I mean,
in the sense that, like, would a production company make that?
I feel like we are kind of inching towards that. I think that we would get that it would still be very controversial now. But I see a possibility.
I mean, we're talking about a time where an all-female version of Ghostbusters has people frothing at the mouth.
And, you know, and what gives me hope is, you know, the new Harry Potter play, Harry and the Cursed Child, has Hermione as a black woman. I mean, and that has created a huge furore. But, like, I think it's really promising that such an iconic character can be quite changeable. It's not, you don't need a rigid sense of what this person ought to be and to look.
But in the Austen's world, there is that sense.
Yeah. I don't know.
There was a bit in the movie in Love and Friendship. It's maybe the one earnest scene of the film, actually, which really kind of upends my argument about maybe it's not as conservative as we think it is.
Yeah.
Where Lady Susan's daughter
Frederica
goes to the church, and she has this conversation with this young pastor about, you know, the commandment, honour thy father and mother.
Yeah, it's a very funny bit where nobody can quite get it right, where, like, is it number four, is it number five or something?
How many commandments are there? It's great. But all the kind of biblical references in the film, like, I think that really creates a moral undertone. There's some discussions of, like, virtue and fairness.
Yeah, so and, like, even the last, one of the last lines is Reginald reading this series of poetic lines about Frederica, and the ending is nothing is more beautiful than virtue, essentially.
Mm. But also this idea of fairness, like, and to be fair, fair is like both, is both like beauty, but also a very specific type of beauty. It's paleness and whiteness. And I think these are values that hold up, like, Western aesthetics. And I think Austen films and the Austen industry propels that kind of aesthetic.
The reason why Lady Susan is such a joy is because for most people this material is very unfamiliar. It's kind of...
I mean, I read Lady Susan for the first time 3 weeks ago, and I read all of Austen's novels. I thought I had.
Yeah. But, and so the pleasure of not knowing how an Austen novel will turn out is just amazing.
It's a very rare thing.
Yeah, it's very rare. And I feel like if Jane Austen added, like, is there a point for another Pride and Prejudice? Not really. I feel like they need to do something like have interesting casting.
Yeah.
In order to problematize.
Yeah. I mean, even the way that we think about Austen is so dependent on this this industry. Like, when you talk to men, for example, about Austen. Like, I've had this conversation so many times with very, very well-read men who haven't read the Bronte sisters, who haven't read Austen. It's usually more so with Austen than the Brontes, but
what do they like to read is, like, Hemingway.
Hemingway, yeah, of course. 20th century male novelists. Thackeray, I don't know. Ooh, no one likes Thackeray. But, like, they don't read Austen, and you get this shtick about, oh, yeah, it's just girls and, like, you know, marriage plot. It's really annoying that Austen has been totally, or the idea of Austen has been usurped by the idea of the marriage plot.
Yeah, I mean, like, period dramas don't exactly help that image. Mm. But, you know, I mean, part of the pleasure of Austen was, like, I'm pretty sure that, like, Jane Austen was read quite frequently by soldiers in World War II. Mm. Like, it was quite...
it's English, right?
Yeah, it's very, very English. I'm not exactly... It possibly was Orwell who said that soldiers from the front would read Jane Austen, keenly aware of her powers as a novelist. And it's really, really... You're right, it's really, really sad. Not that the marriage plot doesn't have a place in the ways in which we love Jane Austen, but it's sort of sad that it's taken the primacy to the fact that in this essay, I think it's Ian Forster who says Jane Austen creates a lot of faithful acolytes who sit in the pews but don't actually listen or read. So when you say you love Jane Austen, is it really because you've read a lot of her novels or you've just really liked, you know, watching Colin Firth 100 times
or like Emerging from the Lake
or having like high teas and things like things that are ancillary are part of the Jane Austen industry but you're not actually consuming Jane Austen in a literary sense.
It's kind of like the first line of Pride and Prejudice, right?
It is a truth.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that all young men...
It is truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a fortune must be in want of a wife.
Right, okay, so there's two ways of reading that, right? Yeah. The first way of reading it is say, okay, yeah, this is true. Yeah. And Austen is telling us a universal truth.
Yeah.
The second way of reading it is saying, this is Mrs. Bennet's truth that Austen is undermining. Yeah. And I think those are the way that you read that opening line... Really, it sets you up for the kind of Austen reader that you will be.
Yeah.
But then again, it's also problematic for us to criticize all the multitude of young women and women out there who love Austen for the marriage plot. But then again, now that we've had this conversation, I'm realizing that, like, the industry around Austen is inherently extremely conservative and patriarchal because it is about the marriage plot.
Yeah.
And that makes me very angry.
I think it problematizes it because also we went through a phase of, like, are we kind of, like...
So we are both ex-presidents of Darcy Society, or the Jane Austen Society.
It was a period drama society. Yeah, so we would not be having this conversation if it were not for, you know, participating in these events.
Exactly, literally. And Jane-eyed culture, and it's only... few years later that we can come out of it and say, oh wait, this is inherently...
Is it hypocritical of us?
Perhaps, but...
I feel a twinge.
No, but I think you need... I think young women... I think there needs to be a space for young women who are interested in books and kind of English culture to kind of come together. But then again, it's also important that these young women kind of have the wake-up call later in life that their lives are inherently run and ruined by the patriarchy. So
I think it's actually
cynical
very...
me, never.
I think it's actually very... I think it's very comforting for young women, especially young women who have not had a lot of exposure to men as one would, you know, when you... For many people, when they first start university, it's like sometimes it's the first time they've really interacted with the opposite sex. And in that sense, like the ways in which men and women circle around each other in Jane Austen novels is similar. And so reading a Jane Austen or reading like Pride and Prejudice gives you a lot of comfort about the anxieties about not really know, like, is this man going to be a Wickham or is he going to be a Mr. Darcy or is he going to be a Mr. Bingley?
Yes.
Or is he going to be a Willoughby?
Or Colonel
There's
Brandon.
A lot of Colonel Brandon. But I do also think that it's untenable to really go through life thinking that a Mr. Darcy exists.
Yeah, or this kind of setting up of the typical comic romance plot that's kind of replicated at all, like contemporary romantic comedies, right? Like of the man and the woman who squabble with each other and then they secretly love each other but they don't know. But it's like when Harry Met Sally or You've Got Mail or anything with Meg Ryan in it.
Yeah.
And that's a plot that I think a lot of people like to play out in their personal lives, but it's also kind of untenable because people don't really relate to each other that way in real life.
No. I think you're also setting yourself up for disappointment. And also, to give you the reality dose, Miss Darcy didn't exist even in that time. I mean, like, I don't want to go through the rants, but, you know, he grew up with a sense of noblesse and living in, like, he's kind of like, a North Korean dictator's son. class sort of strictures. Yeah. I mean, it's extreme, but in terms of ratios of, like, privilege power. And, I mean, it's not a totally over the top
he's like
analogy.
And like a milder version of Rochester. You don't want to marry Rochester. You just don't. You don't want to marry Darcy. Like, he's, you know,
just like somebody who looks down on other people for dancing and says
every Saturday dance.
I know. It's
Mr. Darcy's a racist. Yeah.
I was just gonna about to say. Austin was writing in the height of slavery as well. So, you know, a lot of these heroes in some way or fashion would have gotten their wealth
from the East India Company or what have you.
Exactly. I mean, I don't subscribe to it, but there's an article that an academic has posited that Jane Austen was writing after a specific man and as the model for Mr. Darcy and his wife as the model for Elizabeth Bennet. But and I was very excited, so I started reading about it. And I'll have to put it in the notes, but like, he cheated on his wife lots and lots of times and threw a ball for his mistress just to humiliate his wife, who was like the basis on Elizabeth Bennet, in the sense that she was a very independent woman who was very clever and wrote lots of novels and poetry. So the idea that Mr. Darcy even existed then is a fallacy. Yeah. Why do we keep subscribing to it?
Maybe it's our inherent conservatism.
Yeah.
This idea that there is a morally upright individual out there who, you know, will be swayed by their love for us. I mean, it's absurd. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you think it's fair for us, though, to criticize Janeites? I mean, it begs the question of, like, who owns Austen? Do we own Austen? I mean, do the academics own? Why is there this binary between the academics and the kind of fangirls?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as we sort of almost like excoriate these women who used to be us, how are we to dictate the ways in which we enjoy a particular literary thing? I think it's problematic when it's done en masse and it has effect on society, and we as a collective idea of, like, an embracing this collective idea of femininity. So I think in that way it's bad. But yeah, I mean, I think it's precisely the problem that because people can be very condescending about the fact that when you say that you like Jane Austen.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's probably the issue, I think, if that condescension, which, I mean, is in and of itself rooted in sexism. If that didn't exist, maybe there would be less of this sort of, like, demarcation of being a Janeite and being an academic reader of Jane Austen. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, in a way, us criticizing the cult of Austen, it is inherently sexist, because who are we to kind of, demarcate the boundaries of other women's sexual desires or interests or romantic stories. But then, yeah, you're right. I think also these stories are products of patriarchal institutions, which makes them quite problematic. And I think this kind of critical thinking about Austen needs to occur. But I don't know. Yeah, it's hard. It's complex.
Yeah. I think once we acknowledge the problem of it, I think that goes in a long way of... It's like everything. It's like, you know, I love Hollywood films, but, you know, as we explored in Coen Brothers, the last time we had this had a conversation to an extent. Watching those Hollywood films is also having a sense of nostalgia.
Yeah.
So,
do you think what Stillman and Love and Friendship feeds into that, or is going against that?
I don't know. I sort of feel like he just loves this type of repartee. He just loves this mode. It's like, to a certain extent, the sense of virtue and the sort of moral code. I sort of feel like that underpins mainly his films. But to a extent, I think it's just him luxuriating in this really very witty woman and the sort of coterie of both very clever people and very buffoons that surround her. So it's a sort of an acknowledgement that this past never really existed, but I'm just going to enjoy it anyway.
Right.
Is there anything that you wanted to point out? What were the things that you loved about Lady Susan? I really, the title cards. They were amazing.
Yeah, they were great. I think it was really interesting how Stillman kind of integrated the textuality of the novella into the film. Because, yeah, as you mentioned before, it's an epistolatory novel. And the fact that they bring letters into the story and then have the text on screen of the letters in a way that doesn't seem annoying.
Yeah.
It's like usually when there's text in a film, it's like people sending text messages to each other and it's like, oh, get that away from me.
I really like that font. I need to know what that is.
The font that they do it in, and it's really like charming actually. Yeah. And I think it's a really great way of staying true to the original text.
Yeah. And I love the title cards. They just made me laugh. Like the picture, the first image that we see of the title cards is James Manwaring.
Oh, yeah, Manwaring.
A divinely attractive man. And the moment I saw that, I'm like, okay, yes.
I'm in.
And so my last question is, what is your favourite adaptation of Jane Austen?
I mean, because I'm a sucker of the BBC Pride and Prejudice, but I love Clueless.
Yeah, and why is that?
I think it's just very funny, and I think it perfectly captures that Austen-esque sense of satire and mocking and having inherently, you know, absurd characters.
Yeah.
But it's also got a lot of kind of what's the word when you care about something?
Like earnestness? No.
When you care for a person, compassion, that is the word that I'm clearly a word that doesn't come straight to mind for me. It's got a lot of compassion for his characters also, and whilst it mocks them, you can see that it's also on their side. And I think, I think Clueless...
It's another moral...
Yeah.
Like, another, moral directive.
But I mean, is everything, all acts of literature, or most acts of literature, are moral...
Acts.
Are moral acts, right? It's how it's... Aren't there all these studies done about if you read a lot of books as a child, do you have a greater sense of empathy and a moral code and all that? So, like, I don't know, is morality inherently conservative? Like, I think if that's the world that we've come to, that having good manners is, like, a conservative thing, then, like, I'm sorry, I went out. just, I don't
know. Fair point.
What about you? What's your favourite?
Well, it's different. Okay, so I really, really love Sense and Sensibility, Ang Lee's 1996 production, and he just understands repression so well.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah.
Underneath that is a love story between two people who just can't tell each other that they love each other. And you know, the only way in which he could have made that film is because he really understands that sort of, and it's quite, you know, there's he understands about desire but not being able to act in it, which is not really
and Brokeback Mountain also.
Brokeback Mountain, exactly. And that film is just so beautifully done. And I really like the music by Patrick Doyle, and I think it's cast like amazingly well.
It is probably the most beautiful Austen adaptation.
I think so. I mean, there's nice looking bits in Pride and Prejudice, the Keira Knightley version.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's directed by Joe Wright, who did Atonement and other films, and like beautiful tracking shots, but I'm not saying that that's a good Jane Austen adaptation.
No, I agree. Okay, well, let's not get into that discussion, because we're going to get some angry comments.
My actual favourite is Persuasion. I think it's made in 1995. It's directed by Roger Michell, and it stars Kieran Hines and Amanda Root. And it's just a very autumnal film. It's very grainy. You see a lot of people have dirt in their faces, dirt in their shoes. It's not a very pretty looking film at all, and a lot of people don't like it because neither of the two main actors are at all good looking in the normal Hollywood sense. But it's so captured. Well, Persuasion is my favorite book, my favorite novel of Jane Austen's, and it just captures that sort of melancholy and that autumnal quality. But it's also very good at presenting the satire. A huge pleasure of both the book and the film is Mary Musgrove, and like sister, she's a wonderful character, like the character who, you know, who is not malicious. But just so self-centered. And it's like, I feel like everybody has that person who you can't really hate. But you find exasperating.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I really love that film. I think casting is so important in what makes a good Jane Austen adaptation.
Also, Bridget Jones's Diary.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's so good. Are you going to watch the...
Yes, I will. I feel like I must.
I probably will too. Maybe we should review it.
The Bridget, I don't know. I feel like it's outside of the Bridget Jones canon, so I just...
I mean, we complain about it, but I mean, I could have waited to watch Love and Friendship until now. But we spent like twice as much money to watch it at the film level. So, you know, so I mean, as much as we can kind of have this sort of cringe or a sense of, you know, like maybe we should be more serious about this material, it's still so compelling.
It's true. I mean...
And it's the foundation of how we met, so...
It's true, so I can't hate that. I mean, I deeply love Jane Austen and her novels, and I will admit it. But I'd rather call myself an Austenite than a Janeite, because, you know... No. Beaver secrets, yeah.
The semantics are so important.
That is what would Jane do? She'd probably...
You've got the sticker on your book saying what would Jane do?
You know what Jane would do? She would probably mock us mercilessly... And she'd mock this whole enterprise mercilessly.
But she'd also delight in it.
Yes.
I mean, she really liked dancing.
I mean, yeah. If only she knew that she would become a cult figure.
But, like, erotic fan fiction. Maybe you run into other characters.
I mean, I don't think she would have liked that much.
I feel like that's the price that you pay for becoming a public figure.
Without too much prejudice, perhaps.
Thank you for listening to Erratic Dialogues. Read our essays and listen to more episodes by visiting erraticdialogues.com. That's dialogues with a G-U-E-S. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to us on iTunes.